Okay, so we've been discussing art and L functions. Last time I gave you some basic properties concerning art and L functions. Let me just quickly review the definition. So we have K over F is a finite Galois extension of algebraic number fields . They don't have to be algebraic number fields. They could be function fields, algebraic function fields, over a finite field, and much of the theory carries over, but most of the conjectures are already known in that case. That's why the focus is not on those L functions, although they're very interesting and important. Finite Galois extension, let's say with group G. And so here's our picture. K is my extension. Here's F. Above each prime ideal downstairs, there are a bunch of prime ideals upstairs, such that the prime ideal generated by the German P ideal with the ring of integers of K is a product of these prime ideals. There are finitely many of them. And for each prime ideal script P of capital K, we have what's called a decomposition group consisting of elements of the Galois group which stabilize the prime ideal P. This is called a decomposition group. Of P. And inside the decomposition group, there's a special subgroup called the inertia group, consisting of automorphisms of the group G, consisting of automorphisms of G, which have the following property: sigma of x is congruent to x to the norm German P modulo modulo P for all x in OK. This is called the inertia group at P. And the important fact is that the inertia group is a normal subgroup of the decomposition group, and the quotient group is isomorphic to the Galois group of finite field extensions. So here's my ring of integers of K modulo this prime ideal P. This is a finite field, and I consider that as a finite field extension, I call it F, of these guys, of OK, OF modulo German P. So, and now we know that Galois groups of finite field extensions of finite fields, finite extensions of finite fields are cyclic, generated by the Frobenius automorphism. So this is a Galois group, which is a cyclic group, cyclic, generated by the map x goes to x to the norm P. So so that means that there is an element in the decomposition group which is well-defined modulo inertia such that it maps onto this generator. Okay, and that's called the Frobenius automorphism at P. So Frob P is the element of the decomposition group well-defined modulo inertia that maps to this generator. that maps to this mapping. So this is called the Frobenius automorphism at P. Now, if I fix the prime ideal downstairs, German P downstairs, as I vary over these Frobenius automorphisms, they form a conjugacy class whenever the inertia is trivial. So let's consider the case when, well, there are only finitely many prime ideals when the inertia is non-trivial. Those are the ramified primes. So when the inertia is trivial, the Frobenius automorphism sometimes also denoted sigma p also. I mean, I tend to use both symbols. Is well defined, and as we vary over the prime ideals script P dividing my fixed prime ideal German P downstairs, as we vary over these things, these Frobenius automorphisms are conjugate. They're all conjugate elements, and the conjugacy class is called the art and symbol of the ideal sigma P. And we say that we define the art and symbol sigma to be the conjugacy class of sigma p for any p. So this is the Artin symbol, and using this we can define the Artin L function. So now, given a Galois representation finite dimensional Galois representation where V is a finite dimensional vector space, the complexes. So given such a Galois representation, we can attach the Artin L function corresponding to this piece of data, which we usually denote like this, and it's defined as a product over all the prime ideals German P of F, determinant of 1 minus rho of, well, the characteristic polynomial of the Frobenius automorphism, which, as I said, is well defined modulo the inertia. So this is a well defined characteristic polynomial. So if I restrict my attention to the subspace fixed by inertia, this is a well-defined linear map, and I talk about the characteristic polynomial of that, and that's the definition of the Artin L function attached to this representation. And the famous conjecture of Artin is that if rho is irreducible, unequal to the trivial representation, then L as rho, capital K over F, extends to an entire function. Of S. And the corresponding conjecture of Langlands, so-called Langlands reciprocity conjecture, conjecture is that for any irreducible rho, well, equals one also, but anyway, there exists a automorphic representation pi of rho there exists a cuspidal automorphic representation of GLN of the Adele ring of the base field F, where N is the dimension of rho. So I have a n-dimensional representation of the Galois group. There has to be a cuspidal automorphic representation pi corresponding to the field downstairs, such that the Artin L function is the Artin L function is equal to LS pi. Now I think with my with the notation that Peter was emphasizing, I think this, you see, I think he's right. We should be using L only for the finite places and lambda for the completed L function. Okay, I think otherwise I would have to, you know, complete my Artin L function and then state this theorem. But I think this is, let me just put equals product LS pi P P finite. So this is the Langlands reciprocity conjecture. If it's proved, the Artin conjecture immediately follows, because we know that the right-hand side extends to an entire function by the work of Godemont-Jacquet. So Langlands reciprocity implies Artin's conjecture. So by so this is so what is known about the Artin? What is known? Well, Artin's reciprocity law says that if rho is one-dimensional, then there is an automorphic representation on GL1 such that this identity holds. Then there exists a pi in the space of cuspidal automorphic representations of GL1 AF such that so we do know it in the one-dimensional case. And, pardon me? Just for consistency. Yeah. It will be just a heck yeah. So the Langlands tunnel theorem says that if the image of rho is solvable, if rho is two-dimensional, an image of rho is solvable, then the reciprocity conjecture holds. Now this is what I'd like to focus on for today's lecture, the Langlands tunnel theorem, work my way to also discussing Sarnak's recent theorem about MOS forms and how MOS forms, certain MOS forms, are connected to Galois representations. So kind of come to that. That actually goes in parallel with the de Lin-Serre theorem. So maybe I'll discuss that a little bit for the moment. So this is what's known. Perhaps I make one more comment about Brouwer's theorem. That says that LS rho extends to a meromorphic function and can be in fact expressed as a quotient of products of Heckel functions. The amazing thing about Brouwer's theorem is it's just pure group theory combined with simple functoriality of Hartnell functions. The years in which these things have been proved, I think, should be mentioned to give you an idea of the chronology of events. That's 1928. This is 1975. Langlands and the tunnel part is 1981, I believe. And the Brouwer's theorem is the 1953, I think, or thereabouts. I mean, these are not exact dates, but it gives you an idea, at least, that there's a considerable time span between these major theorems. This is just pure group theory. So what are these theorems saying? These theorems are saying the following thing. If you give me a Galois, if you give me a certain Galois representation, I can find an automorphic form such that the L functions match up. That's what these theorems are saying. We can ask about the other direction. We can ask, if I give you an automorphic form which should have come from a Galois, can you construct the Galois representation? What about the converse direction of the reciprocity conjecture? What about the converse direction? That is, given an automorphic representation pi of GLN, can we always construct a Galois representation, rho, construct a Galois representation, rho, such that the art and L function equals, sometimes I drop the fields, okay, that's just, and sometimes you put them in, depending on the convenience of the situation. But yeah, because given a cuspid automorphic representation. Well, I mean, I'm just asking a general question. So the point is that it will not be the case that you can always find a Galois representation. So Langlands reciprocity conjecture is saying that all Galois representations must correspond to automorphic representations. So the question is, so if I have the universe of cuspidal automorphic representations, according to the reciprocity conjecture, Galois representations have to sit inside. So this is a conjectural picture, of course. And the question now is, are there any elements outside? And the answer is, of course, a yes. It's easy to construct. In fact, I already did. The Hecke L functions that we the Moss forms that I constructed correspond to, would have Fourier coefficients, which are transcendental numbers. Okay? And as you can see from this definition, these are finite dimensional representations of finite groups, and therefore this is just a product of 1 minus lambda I over p to the s, where lambda I is a root of unity. So all the coefficients that appear in the Dirichlet series defining an art and L function are algebraic numbers, algebraic numbers. And therefore, we can only expect, you know, if you give me a, so it would be a reasonable thing to ask, given a cuspidal automorphic representation you know, L function, the finite part of the L function, has a Dirichlet series expansion whose coefficients are all algebraic integers, can that be made to tally with a Galois representation? Now, the answer to that question, I don't know. But probably not. Probably it's possible to construct even those. So the question is then, when can we do such a thing? Now, the simplest case, case of automorphic representations, apart from the one-dimensional case, are the ones coming from GL2, which correspond to modular forms. So this is the content of Delin-Serre theorem. So if F is a classical Hecke eigenform, of weight 1, on gamma naught of n, with an Eben type as say epsilon. I mean, you don't need to worry about this word, which is normalized. Then, with the property, let's see. So give me a classical Hecke eigenform, then there exists a Galois representation rho sub f by the way, Galois representations, because of the profinite topology, these all factor through a finite extension, so it's really Galois K over Q for some finite extension. two-dimensional complex linear representation such that the Artin L function attached to this Galois representation is the L function attached by Hecke to the classical eigenform. Now these things have the property such we have necessarily that the determinant of rho, which is see rho is a two-dimensional character, and taking the determinant makes it a one-dimensional character. The determinant of rho is a classical Dirichlet character, which has to be necessarily odd. Is an odd Dirichlet character. That means that evaluated at minus one, it's minus one. It's an odd Dirichlet character. So the de Lin-Serre theorem, to some extent, answers some subset of the question that I asked in the case that n equals 2. If you give me a classical Hecke eigenform, then there is a Galois representation such that you can make the Artin L function match up to the L function attached to the Hecke eigenform. So what happens if you... Now, we know that the automorphic representations of GL2 of the Adele ring of the rational numbers can be classified according to whether or not they're holomorphic or not. In the case of holomorphy, you have classical modular forms. In the case of non-holomorphic, we have the Moss forms. So now if you give me a Moss form with is there a Galois representation Okay, so this takes at least a part of the universe of cuspidal two-dimensional automorphic representations and constructs Artin L functions to them. But what about Moss forms? What about Moss forms? Well, generically, Moss forms are going to be ones with... generically, it's expected that the Fourier coefficients of a Moss form are transcendental numbers in general, unless the corresponding eigenvalue is a quarter. So it is conjectured that the Fourier coefficients of a Moss form with eigenvalues lambda not equal to a quarter are transcendental numbers. This being verified only in some special cases, like the kind of construction I did earlier with Moss forms, transcendental numbers. And so these things, so a Moss form with eigenvalue lambda, which is not a quarter, probably doesn't correspond to a Galois representation. So one would expect that these do not correspond to Galois representations. So what about when lambda equals a quarter? Well, here again, I don't think anyone will be bold enough to make the assertion that all mass forms with lambda equal to a quarter have algebraic Fourier coefficients. I don't think anyone's going to say that. But you have the following remarkable theorem of Sarnak. That if pi is a cuspidal automorphic representation of GL2AQ, which corresponds to a Mass form, eigenvalue lambda equal to a quarter, and Fourier coefficients are all integers, ordinary integers, rational integers. And the Fourier coefficients are all in Z, ordinary integers, then there exists a Galois representation. There's an Artinel function. There exists a Galois representation, rho sub pi, which is with determinant rho sub pi even. It's a Dirichlet character, so it's an even Dirichlet character. And Ls rho sub pi is equal to Ls pi. Again, these are the finite parts of the L function that I keep putting down. So this is what I would like to talk about next week, but these two lectures kind of are connected. And this particular theorem uses the full force of the results by Kim and Shahidi on the automorphy of the symmetric cube and the symmetric fourth power. So it's a good way to end this course. All right. Pardon me? Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry about that. Thanks. I think that's a consequence. You see, when he assumes that the coefficients are integers, he deduces that the image has to be necessarily solvable. Yeah, yeah. That comes out. Yeah. So, yeah. So that's part of the conclusion, I think, rather than a hypothesis. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. That's a conclusion. Yeah, I'll be more precise when I do it next week. But I just wanted to show people that this is like a companion theorem to the Dillon-Serre theorem. Okay, so this is the Mass form side of the Dillon-Serre theorem. And the problem with this thing is that this works only over Q. The Dillon-Serre theorem at the moment has been only established over Q. I think that we can state this a little bit more general. I'll have to check the paper. I didn't bring it with me now, but... Pardon me? Yes, but only for a quadratic extension, I think, in some special cases. It's not in full generality, I think. Yeah, in some special cases. And there's still some problems. You're talking about the work of Taylor and others. Blazius and Taylor, yeah, yeah. I think you mean Taylor?
Not Taylor, but.
Yeah, I know that. I thought it was only done for certain fields and not in general.
Totally real fields.
Oh, okay.
I love field, yeah. But if your cusp form comes from a Kalman representation, there is no restriction on the infinite type.
The lambda equals a quarter already restricted, because
yes,
you see the gap. Yeah, yeah. The infinity type.
But you can probably rephrase this in terms of say what the infinite component is there.
So from the Galois point of view, there's a restriction. That right.
Yeah.
Just from if you have a two-dimensional Galois representation, is it known what the gamma factors have to be?
Yeah. Yeah. That's like. Yeah.
So then you know an a priori restriction on the infinity type.
Yes.
Yes.
For all Artinel functions, the gamma factors that appear are either gamma s over 2 or gamma s plus 1 over 2, just like in the classical Dirichlet L function case. There'll always be a bunch of gamma s over 2, depending on you know what the character's doing, and gamma s plus 1 over 2. It can't be arbitrary for Galois representations. That's why I'm saying that in this, it is a proper subset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This statement doesn't imply that it has to be one quarter.
No, it doesn't imply it. But I think he assumes that the eigenvalue has to be a quarter. I'll have to check the paper. I couldn't find it this morning.
Yeah,
that's I think. So I'm just trying to be safe. I'll state the precise theorem next week. Okay, when I find the paper, he gave it to me last week, but I don't know where I put it.
Yeah, but to say if the gamma factors are known, which can come up, it also means that you can say something about the lambdas, which might occur.
Yeah. They have to be. I would say they would have to be integers of some or rational numbers. Certainly, they would certainly have to be rational numbers, because all the gamma factors in an Artinel function are of the form gamma s over 2 or gamma s plus 1 over 2. So if you were using some sort of duplication formulas, you're only going to end up with rational numbers. So this much is clear. But I think probably a quarter is forced on you. That would be my guess.
I mean, this would be another argument that probably most of the mass forms don't
correspond to Galois representations, of course. Yeah, that's right. Good question. I think so. I think he constructs an example at the end of the paper. He actually gives a specific example. Okay. The interesting thing is that the turning point in Artin's conjecture is 1975 with Langlands book Base Change for GL2. And the opening chapter really is a sensation to read. It's really a pity he didn't get the Fields Medal in Vancouver that following year. But certainly that's the turning point. The turning point when the theory of automorphic forms starts having applications to number theory in a sort of serious sort of way. In the opening chapter, he describes two proofs of how one could kind of go around doing this. One of them only works over Q, and that's the one I think I'll probably finish with today. The other one works over arbitrary fields, a little bit more harder, and has to use the symmetric square lift in a much very careful sort of way. So, okay. Now, right now, what I want to do is indicate a couple of basic properties, or what one could deduce from the interaction of group theory with Galois representation. So this is an idea which goes back to Heilbronn, and subsequently developed by Stark. And then Kumar and Richard Foote gave it such a streamlined treatment that this will look like child's play. So let's fix a complex number, S0, in the complex plane, and suppose that you have a Galois extension with group G. And suppose H is a subgroup, and so we look at the fixed field of H, so we have a finite extension, so H is this, the Galois group of K over KH. And for each, so let's look notation. G hat will denote the set of irreducible characters of G. Characters of G. So for each psi, which is an irreducible character of H, let's denote, let NH psi be the order of the Artin L function attached to psi. So we know by Brouwer's theorem that these are all, you give me any Galois representation, you look at the Artin L function, it's a mirror morphic function, and therefore it makes sense to talk about the order of the function at the point. It will be an integer. And Artin's conjecture would be the assertion that whenever these psi is irreducible, these things are always non-negative integers. So you look at this. Order of the zero or the pole, it wouldn't matter.
Well, one's positive and one's negative.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Yeah. It's whatever it is, positive or negative.
That thing which you're using.
Yeah. I fixed S naught, though. It does depend on S naught, but I fixed it. All right. Yeah, if there's a zero at that point, it will be a positive integer. And if there's a pole, I take it as a negative integer. Now we form the Heilbrun character, theta H of G. Call this the Heilbrun character. So it's a well-defined virtual character because the coefficients could be integers, negative integers as well. So you have a nice generalized character here. And this is the little lemma that if I look at the Heilbrun character for the full group G and I restrict it to H, then it's the same as theta sub H. Because it's a very neat functorial property of the Heilbrun character. Now let's see why. So theta G restricted to H is the same as N G chi restricted to H. So theta G as a generalized character is a summation N G chi times chi. So I restricted, so each of these characters are restricted to H. That's what it is. But now, chi restricted to H, it's a good character, I mean, it's a generalized character on H, can be Fourier analyzed, and I can write this in terms of the irreducible characters of H. So we can write chi restricted to H can be written as a linear combination of irreducible characters of H. What are the things that go in here? Well, those are the inner products. Like the orthogonality relations, that's what it is. So I can plunk that in here and do as we always do, interchange summations. You can always remember what to do once you know where to start. Now you have Frobenius reciprocity, which tells us that the inner product of chi restricted to H, this is an inner product on H, and if I want to take it as an inner product on G, I can rewrite that inner product of the induction chi with the induction of H to G of psi. So by Frobenius reciprocity. If you don't know Frobenius reciprocity, I suggest you just quickly review Sayre's book Linear Representations of Finite Groups. Probably the best book as an introduction to finite group theory. The book was written for chemists at the insistence of his wife, I heard. So,
the first chapter.
Oh, the first chapter. Well, that's enough. That's enough for this. The first chapter is enough. Now, I'd like to know what that thing inside is. Let's understand what that thing inside is. So what is that thing inside? So what is this? So let's write down, what was NG chi in the first place? It's the order of the zero. And S naught of LS chi that. Now these are a bunch of integers, okay? So I can take the summation inside, you know, stick this in here as a coefficient, and this is the same as let's not do that. Let's look at, so what is this? let's look at LS psi k to kh. What is this? This is an Artnell function attached to this relative extension. Okay. Now, by the functorial properties of Artnell functions, we know that they're invariant under induction. So this is the same thing as the Artnell function of the full guy. Okay? And we know that every generalized character of a group decomposes as integer linear combinations of irreducible characters. So if I want to write this as a bunch of characters, what do I do? I just take the inner product and write it with chi, right? Everybody okay with that? So this induced character is a linear combination of chi's, and these are the guys that go in front of them. Therefore, by the additivity property of the Artnell functions, this is nothing but product over the Artnell functions attached to chi, k over f, to the power chi in there. So that's what it is over all the irreducible characters of chi. Therefore, this L function is the same as this L function, which is a product of all these L functions. Therefore, the order of the zero of this L function at S0 is equal to the sum of the orders of the zeros. So this is nothing but NH psi. So three things we use. Frobenius reciprocity. So four things. Frobenius theorem first. Frobenius reciprocity. Invariance under induction and additivity of the Artnell functions. And you get it. So that thing inside is NH psi. So stick it in here, NH psi times psi, and that's exactly this. So Lemma's proof. I think that this is really a deep thing, and it's a pity we don't know how to use it. But Stark and Kumar and Richard Foote used it very well to show that Artnell functions are entire or analytic at whenever the Dedekind zeta function has either simple zero or a double order zero. So, which is very important in questions of analytic number theory, where a simple zero can, if it doesn't exist, has serious consequences. As we know, if a simple zero doesn't exist, you know, it can revolutionize much of mathematics. So this is nothing but simple properties of the Artnell function combined with some simple group theory. Now consider the inner product of this Heilbrun character with itself. Let's consider the norm of the Heilbrun character. By definition, that's the definition of the inner product. Okay. On one hand, over irreducible characters, on one hand, theta sub g is ng chi summation ng chi chi, so the inner product of theta g with itself is by the orthogonality relations nothing but ng chi squared. So that's what this is. On the other hand, we've finished proving that theta G, when you restrict it to a subgroup H, is the same as theta H. Group generated by G, by the lemma. Right? When you restrict that thing. So now, the question is, what is theta GG? So now, theta, if H is abelian, what is theta H of G? Well, these are Art and L functions corresponding to an abelian extension. And so these are all one-dimensional characters, and NH psi is the order of the Art and L function of an abelian. Oops. An abelian L function. And abelian L functions by Artin's reciprocity are entire. So, by Artin's reciprocity, they're non-negative. Okay. So, that means that theta G of G is equal to N characters of the cyclic group, so that theta G of G is at most I put absolute values on each one. Absolute values of psi of G is at most one, because these are abelian characters, the one-dimensional things. But, as I said, for abelian groups, these guys are non-negative, so I can actually remove these absolute values. Now, what is that? Well, if I have an abelian extension and I'm going over all the irreducible characters, we know that the Dedekind zeta function is a product of Art and L functions. In the abelian case, I mean, this I'll talk about this in the general case too later. But in the abelian case, the product of the abelian L functions corresponding to this this abelian extensions K over KH is equal to the Dedekind zeta function of the top field. Therefore, if I fix an S naught and I'm calculating the order of the L function at S naught and I'm summing it over all the characters psi, that's the order of the Dedekind zeta function at the top. So this is nothing but the order of the Dedekind zeta function of the top guy. So I've used art and reciprocity. This is the first deep fact I think I've used in this derivation. That's just group theory. The lemma is just nothing but group theory and basic functorial properties of art and L functions. I mean, invariance under induction is really group theory again, and seeing what prime ideals do and the Frobenius automorphism, how it behaves under extensions. So that's really basic algebraic number theory combined with basic group theory. But here I think I'm using something very deep to remove the absolute values on these things, because this is already non-negative. And it deduce that this is really the order of the Dedekind zeta function. It's an inequality. Yeah, this no longer depends on the group. Right. So I go back here now, and I realize that each of these elements here is at most the order of the Dedekind zeta function. And therefore, I get the following theorem. I mean, you can play other games too with Parseval and whatnot with two different points, S0 and S1 and things like that, but this is about the cleanest result you can kind of get from this analysis. And out of this analysis come spectacular consequences. The first being that if the Dedekind zeta function has no zero or a pole, all the Artin L functions are analytic at that point. So corollary number one. Exactly. Good point. But let me just state corollary number one first. If S naught is not equal to one, and zeta k of S naught is not zero, then any Artin L function of is regular at S equal to S naught. And as you point out, corollary number two, if S naught equals one, then what do we have here? Then order of the pole of the Dedekind zeta function is minus 1. And so on the right-hand side, I'm going to get 1 here. But remember that in the collection of irreducible characters, there's also the trivial character. And corresponding to the trivial character, the Artin L function is the Dedekind zeta function of the base field. And we know that NG1 is minus 1 also. And therefore, that accounts for everything. That 1 already gives me a 1 here, and this has to be bounded by 1. That accounts for everything, and all the other ones are, they better be 0. So not only are they regular there, but they don't vanish there. In particular, all the zeros of the Artin L functions are contained in the zeros of the Dedekind zeta function. So we get that NG chi is equal to 0 for all chi not equal to 1. In other words, the Artin L function is regular at S equals 1 and non-vanishing there, which is the punchline for Chebotar identity theorem. So L1 chi k over F is not 0. This is essentially equivalent to the Chebotar identity theorem. Not only that, this is the kind of the Dirichlet density version you can deduce from this. But we know that the Dedekind zeta function doesn't vanish on the line real part s equals 1. Therefore, all the Artnell functions are analytic for real part s bigger than or equal to 1 and non-vanishing there. In fact, corollary 3, we know as zeta k of s is not 0 for real part s equals greater than or equal to 1, s not equal to 1, we immediately deduce all the Art and L functions. Remember, I told you last week that I have a tendency to sometimes use a representation, sometimes use a character. It doesn't matter. Up to equivalence, it's determined by the character. The representation is determined uniquely up to equivalence by the character, so it doesn't really matter. Now, this thing is regular for real part s greater than or equal to 1 and non-vanishing there. So, by Tauberian theory, we deduce the asymptotic formula. It's the asymptotic version of Chebotarov. Now, the Dedekind zeta function of the base field has a pole only at s equals 1, and it's regular everywhere else. So notice from the inequality we have that the absolute value of ng chi is at most the order of the zero. So the order of the pole of any Art and L function, if it exists, is at most the order of the zero of the Dedekind zeta function. Already dismissed s equals 1, so I don't have to worry about minus 1 on the right-hand side. In particular, if chi equals 1, ng chi, ng 1, which is the order of the zero of the Dedekind zeta function of the base field, is less than or equal to the order of the zero. The reason I took away the absolute values on this side is because we know these are all non-negative. This is an F here. Now, we know that these are all non-negative, so I dropped this. Dropped the absolute values. So what does that say? The order of the Dedekind zeta function of the downstairs field is always less than or equal to the order of the Dedekind zeta function of the upstairs field. So what that means, we get the following corollary, usually called the Brouwer-Aramata theorem. Zeta k of s, or zeta f of s, is entire. So the Dedekind zeta function of the downstairs field divides the upstairs field, Dedekind zeta function. So now if K over F is not Galois, this is still an open conjecture. It's called Dedekind's conjecture. If K over F is not Galois, so this is conjectured in general, it would follow from Artin's conjecture. This would follow. So, Dedekind's conjecture. Is that if K over F is an arbitrary, not necessarily Galois, extension, finite, arbitrary finite extension of algebraic number fields, then the Dedekind zeta function of the top guy is divisible by the Dedekind zeta function of the bottom guy. So all the zeros of the Dedekind zeta function of F must lie in the Dedekind zeta function of the top guy. So this is still unknown. This would follow. From Artin's conjecture. This is probably the slickest proof of Brauer-Arrmada theorem I know. In this inequality here? No, we don't.
So on the right side is negative 1, and the left hand side is
negative 1. Oh, when S naught is equal to 1. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think maybe we treat that differently. Yeah, okay. Okay, okay. Otherwise, yeah, you're right. Okay, let's assume S naught is not 1. But I think that one could probably get around this point. Okay, yeah. When S naught is equal, I'll leave that as an exercise for you, okay? When S naught is equal to 1, this definitely can be, we know everything about this. These are abelian characters. None of them are vanishing except for the trivial character we have, it's minus. So we know exactly what it is. Yes, we should be a little cautious about it. All right. Now, in an important consequence, which I will, an important consequence of the Chebotaro density theorem, which I will more or less leave as an exercise, is if row 1 and row 2 are Galois representations, are irreducible representations of some sort of finite Galois extension, then the Artin L function corresponding to the tensor product representation. Okay, so here now I'm switching back to my representation theoretic notation, which would correspond to, if I wanted to write this in terms of characters, product of two characters, chi1, chi2 bar. Okay, in my notation of characters, this Artin L function would then decompose as a product of Artin L functions attached to irreducible characters. We can decompose LS chi1, chi2 bar, k over f, as a product of LS chi K over F. And with what exponents? The exponents will be chi 1, chi 2 bar, the inner product with chi. We have this. Now we just learned that the Art and L functions don't vanish at S equals 1. Okay? And so you would expect, so they don't vanish at S equals 1, and the only one that has any problem with it is the trivial character. So the question is, what's the multiplicity of the trivial character in this decomposition? Well, it's clear. The inner product of chi 1, chi 2 bar with 1 is the same as the inner product with chi 1 with chi 2. So the pole arises at S equals 1. So let's see. We analyze this at S equals 1. The right-hand side is regular for all chi not equal to 1. For chi equal to 1, the order of the pole for chi equals 1, the order of the pole LS chi 1 chi 2 bar K over F has a pole at S equals 1 of order equal to the inner product chi 1 chi 2 bar with 1. Well, the inner product of chi 1 chi 2 bar with 1 is the same as the inner product of chi 1 with chi 2. By definition of the inner product. But chi 1 and chi 2 are irreducible characters. So this is 0 if chi 1 is not equal to chi 2, and 1 when chi 1 equals chi 2. So, just like in the automorphic context, you distinguish two different automorphic representations by taking Rankine-Selberg and figuring out whether there's a pole or not. Similarly, on the Galois theoretic context, the same mechanism, well, it should work if there's a functoriality going on. It better be the case. And this is it. This is telling us that the Art and L function attached to the tensor product of two Galois representations has a pole precisely when rho 1 is isomorphic to rho 2. It has no pole otherwise. So this is the way you distinguish when two Galois representations are isomorphic. So you can use this Rankine-Selberg construction on the Galois theory side to do that. Now I think I have all the ingredients to indicate Langland's first proof of the tetrahedral case of the Artin conjecture. So, Langland's first proof. Let me explain what I'm saying here. There's a famous theorem of Felix Klein which tells us that if it classifies the finite subgroups of PGL2C. they are either cyclic or they're dihedral of order 2 times n, where n is a cyclic part, or it's A4, 4, it's S4, 5, it's A5. These are the only possible, so any finite subgroup is either cyclic or dihedral or is isomorphic to one of these three. Okay. And if you need a place to look up a proof, Lang, Introduction to Modular Forms. And there he has an appendix by Walter Feit, which gives a very clean and painless undergraduate type style proof using the class equation to determine all the finite subgroups. Now, if I have a two-dimensional Galois representation, of course, which is irreducible, so if we have a two-dimensional Galois representation which is a complex linear representation, and I mod out by the scalars and take the projection map, because this is a finite group, it's a finite extension, the image is going to be a finite subgroup here, and we say that the two-dimensional Galois representation is one of these five types according to its image. Okay? Now, in the case that the image is cyclic or dihedral, if the image of rho is cyclic or dihedral, one can show by using simple group theory, and this was known to Hecke, one can show that rho is really the induction from H to G of some psi, where psi is one-dimensional, and H is of index 2. Is normal, is of index 2. Index 2 is normal, right? is of index 2, and hence normal. And so the art and L function attached to this thing is just going to correspond to an abelian character, and therefore we're done. It corresponds to a Galois extension, okay? And by using cyclic automorphic induction, you can deduce that it corresponds to an automorphic form downstairs, okay? So I'll leave this as an exercise kind of too. So so one can deduce. One can deduce that LS rho is entire, not only that, and in fact corresponds to an automorphic representation. I'll leave that as kind of like an exercise. So the first difficult case is really this A4 case. It's called the tetrahedral case because A4 can be realized as symmetries of the tetrahedron. S4 can be realized as a symmetry group of the octahedron. And A5 can be realized as a symmetry group of the icosahedron. So this corresponding to each of these things, we have these names, the tetrahedral case, the octahedral case, and the icosahedral case. Now, since I'm running out of time, in fact, I have run out of time. But if you give me about 2 minutes, I'll indicate the first proof. This case was done by tunnel using non-cubic lift, non-cubic, well, non-Galois cubic extension lift of Gelbart and JK. Here we have some recent work of many people which non-Galois cubic, yeah, sorry. Non-Galois is the non should go with the Galois, not the cubic. Non-Galois cubic lift Jacquet, PS, and Schleicher. So I'll discuss that next time. Maybe I actually will stop now because I think I've got all the ingredients on the blackboard. So next week what I'll do is refresh your memory on the Dillon-Serre theorem and then show the first proof of how it pops out very neatly. Okay? And then indicate the tetrahedral case in some detail. And then wave my hands on the S4 case, and then finish off with Sarnak's theorem. Okay? Yeah.